Imagine building this massive, multi-million dollar tech platform, running it successfully for 5 years, and then realizing your biggest, most expensive mistake was actually giving your engineering teams too much freedom.
Yeah, that is a tough pill to swallow.
Right. Today, we're looking at what is essentially a masterclass in why total flexibility can actually be your worst enemy. Welcome to the deep dive. We're unpacking a really phenomenal, candid essay from a technology leader who just spent, 15 years in the cloud business.
Man, they didn't just build these systems anywhere. They built them in the highly regulated, incredibly strict world of financial services.
Which changes the game completely.
Oh, absolutely. That financial services context frames everything we're going to discuss today. Because when you build software for a bank or a trading firm, security, auditability, and cost control, they aren't optional features.
Right, you can't just pencil them in for some phase two maturity cycle next year.
Exactly. They have to be baked into the bedrock from the very first line of code. I mean, the regulatory fines alone for a data breach or a compliance failure mean the stakes are simply too high to treat security as an afterthought.
Which brings us to the core mission of today's deep dive. The author of our source material built two massive cloud environments completely from zero. They call these greenfield builds.
Right, meaning there's no legacy code, no ancient servers, just a totally blank slate.
Just a blank slate.
Yeah.
And their central thesis is basically a wake-up call for anyone building a long-term project. They argue that the small, seemingly minor administrative decisions you make in year one completely dictate whether you end up with a functional, elegant platform or, an absolute chaotic pile of technical debt in year five.
It's so true.
So even if you wouldn't know how to code a basic website, stick with us, because this conversation is really about systems thinking, team dynamics, and avoiding compounding debt in whatever organization you're trying to build.
Yeah, to understand how a tech platform actually survives and scales over a 5-year horizon, we really need to look at the very first major battle this author fought.
The day one stuff.
Exactly. This was a decision made before a single application was ever deployed to their new cloud.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because going back to the early days of cloud computing, the massive selling point for developers was ultimate freedom.
Oh, yeah. Move fast and break things.
Right. The pitch was always, hey, bypass the IT department, just grab a corporate credit card, spin up a server in AWS, and just get to work. But this author absolutely refused to let their organization operate that way.
They put the brakes on hard.
They really did. They insisted on building a centralized landing zone first. They forced the company to stop and build shared networking, centralized logging, and identity systems before anyone was allowed to host a single business application.
Which is a huge structural decision.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a bit like laying down an entire city grid, the subterranean water pipes, the sewer lines, the power grid, and telling eager homeowners they have to just sit on their hands and wait to build their houses until the pavement dries. I have to imagine application teams were incredibly frustrated waiting behind all this, bureaucratic red tape.
What's fascinating here is that the author fully admits the early friction was brutal. I mean, the development teams were loudly complaining about delays.
I bet.
Yeah, the author even had to defend this slow timeline to executive leadership who were terrified they had just hired a team to build a massive, expensive bottleneck.
That's a scary spot to be in as a leader.
It is. But the core lesson they learned, and the reason the long-term payoff was so immense, is that large-scale platforms only truly work when the correct defaults are inherited, not chosen.
By inherited, you mean like the security settings apply automatically
Yeah.
without anyone having to click a button?
Precisely that. Human nature basically dictates that if a software team has to manually opt in to complex observability tools or strict security protocols, a large chunk of them simply won't do it.
Because they're in a rush.
Right. They're under pressure to ship features, so they'll cut corners. And the few teams that actually do take the time to implement security, they'll do it slightly differently than everyone else, creating this huge patchwork.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So by building that centralized landing zone first, the author ensured that every single workload deployed into their environment automatically inherited the exact same guardrails. The system basically forced compliance.
That is incredibly smart.
Yeah.
So when external auditors inevitably showed up 5 years later demanding to know exactly what was running and who had access to it, the organization could just like pull the receipts in minutes.
Exactly.
While companies that skip that foundational step are probably still frantically running around with Excel spreadsheets, trying to hunt down shadow accounts tied to like an intern's email address from 3 years ago.
Oh, that happens way more often than anyone wants to admit. And establishing those firm, inherited guardrails early on allowed the author to achieve something they call the dark factory.
Okay, that concept completely changed how I think about software delivery.
It's a great analogy. In advanced physical manufacturing, a dark factory is a plant that runs entirely lights out. There are zero human beings on the factory floor, so you literally don't even need to turn the lights on.
Just robots doing everything.
Right. The robotics and assembly lines are fully automated. The author takes this physical concept and applies it to software engineering. They argue that the automated delivery pipeline itself is the actual product the platform team is building.
And the software application.
The software application that the developers are writing. That's merely the payload moving down the conveyor belt.
Yeah. That flips the traditional developer mindset entirely upside down. Usually the application is treated as the star of the show, and the deployment pipeline is just, you know, the boring plumbing you use to get the app onto a server.
Yeah, but when you treat the pipeline as the primary product, you encode all of your institutional knowledge into the machinery itself. Think about the mechanics of it.
Walk me through it.
So a developer finishes writing a piece of code and submits it. Instantly, the dark factory takes over. The system automatically spins up a testing environment, runs 500 automated security tests, scans the code for known vulnerabilities, checks for compliance issues, and if it passes, deploys it straight to live production.
And humans aren't touching it at all during that process.
That's the crucial detail. Humans never log in to the production servers.
Because if humans are logging in, they're making manual changes, and suddenly your system behaves unpredictably.
Exactly.
The guardrails stop relying on a heroic senior engineer remembering to check a security box on a Friday afternoon, and instead they live permanently inside the automated system.
The machine executes the process flawlessly every time. But, you know, setting up an automated factory floor naturally leads to the next massive challenge.
Deciding exactly what language the human engineers will use to program the machinery.
Right.
Which brings us to a highly debated decision the author made regarding tooling. They had to choose an infrastructure tool to build this platform.
And this is where it gets a bit technical, but bear with me.
Yeah, they opted for a tool called Terraform over the native tool provided by Amazon Web Services, which is called CloudFormation. Now, since they were building primarily on AWS, choosing Amazon's native tool seems like the path of least resistance. Why actively choose a third-party tool?
They chose Terraform for two strategic reasons that actually go far beyond just writing code. The first was the sheer breadth of its provider ecosystem.
Meaning it works with more than just Amazon.
Exactly. CloudFormation was fantastic for configuring Amazon resources, but a modern cloud platform is rarely contained to just AWS. You need to configure DNS, which is basically the internet's phone book that points users to your website. You need to manage identity providers, like Okta, to handle employee logins. You need secret managers, which are essentially highly secure digital vaults for your application's passwords and API keys. Terraform could talk to all of these different systems using the exact same syntax.
So instead of an engineer learning five different proprietary configuration languages to set up one application, they learn a single mental model and use it to command the entire technological landscape.
That unified approach leads directly to the author's second reason, which they call cognitive portability.
Cognitive portability, I like that.
Yeah, when an engineer spends a year mastering Terraform, that skill transfers to almost any other tech company in the world. Conversely, when the author's company hired a new engineer from the outside, that new hire was writing productive code within a week because they already knew the tool.
It's essentially a brilliant recruiting and retention strategy, cleverly disguised as an architectural decision.
That's exactly what it is.
And the author points out that betting heavily on this specific skill held its value all the way through recent industry turbulence, like sudden vendor licensing changes and the open source software fork called OpenTofu.
Right.
But reading about this deep investment in a specific coding language made me pause. Because we are living through the sudden rise of generative AI, where a chatbot can fluently write code in any of these languages on command.
Oh, the AI question, yeah.
Yeah. If I can just ask an AI to instantly translate my CloudFormation script into Terraform, does standardizing on a single tool choice even matter anymore?
The author actually addresses that exact nuance, and their conclusion is sharp. Generative AI absolutely lowers the cost of choosing the wrong tool because the AI acts as a universal translator and can write the boilerplate code for you.
Right.
But what AI does not lower is the massive cost of fragmenting your human team.
Because the humans still have to talk to each other.
Exactly. Having one unified language isn't just about writing the code faster. It's about how the team communicates, how they review each other's work for logical flaws, and how they collectively govern the system.
You can't run a cohesive engineering culture as a Tower of Babel.
No, even if an AI is sitting in the middle translating the dialects, the culture still breaks down.
That makes a lot of sense. The cognitive load of switching contexts would still drag the team down.
And speaking of the humans building the system, the author had a highly opinionated philosophy on hiring.
They really did.
Yeah, they actively avoided hiring deep specialists. They didn't want network gurus. They didn't want people whose entire identity was wrapped up in being a master of Kubernetes, which, for you listening, is the incredibly complex engine used to manage massive clusters of software containers.
Right.
They didn't want IAM experts, people who only focus on identity and access management permissions. Instead, they sought out generalists, specifically T-shaped engineers. T-shaped is a classic industry term. It means an individual possesses a broad general understanding across a wide variety of disciplines that forms the horizontal bar of the T. But they also possess deep, hands-on expertise in maybe one or two specific areas, forming the vertical stem.
Okay, but I have to push back hard on this concept on behalf of anyone who has ever managed a severe crisis.
Let's hear it.
Imagine your multi-million dollar trading platform completely crashes at 2 a.m. Millions of dollars are evaporating by the minute. Are you honestly telling me you want to wake up a generalist who has to frantically Google how the database architecture works?
Well,
That sounds like corporate negligence. I would want the absolute undisputed database guru handling that outage. Why wouldn't you hire a team of elite specialists?
if we connect this to the bigger picture of how systems evolve, the fundamental flaw with deep specialists is that they inevitably transform into bottlenecks.
How so?
When you hire the undisputed Kubernetes guru, every single Kubernetes problem naturally routes through them. Because they are so capable, the system's complexity begins to harden around them. The organization starts to unknowingly design architectures that rely on that specific person's genius.
Oh, I see. They inadvertently become a human gatekeeper.
They do. And if
Yeah.
that guru goes on vacation or, quits, the system grinds to a halt. When you rely on T-shaped generalists, you can't afford to build a system so complex that only one person can decipher it.
That forces simplicity.
Exactly. Generalists are forced to build self-healing architectures, heavily automated runbooks, and simpler designs precisely because they aren't gurus. Furthermore, the technology landscape shifts rapidly.
Right, things change.
When the industry moved away from managing containers and towards serverless technology, where you just run code without actively managing the underlying servers at all, the author didn't have to orchestrate a massive corporate reorganization to fire the container specialists and hire a serverless team.
Because their generalists possessed the broad engineering fundamentals required to reason their way through the new paradigm.
Right. They understood the underlying physics of software, not just the knobs and dials of one specific machine.
And this philosophy bled directly into how they managed the team itself. They championed the idea of treating infrastructure as a product.
Which is such a vital mindset.
It is. The platform engineering team wasn't treated like a group of basement mechanics just keeping the servers humming. They operated with a dedicated product manager, they published a roadmap, and they treated the internal application developers as their valued customers.
That psychological shift is critical for survival. If a centralized platform team operates with lower engineering standards than the application teams they are supposed to serve, the platform almost instantly becomes what the author brilliantly calls a blame magnet.
Oh, I've seen that happen. Every delayed feature, every bug, suddenly gets blamed on the platform being clunky.
Exactly. The moment the platform becomes difficult to use, the application teams will quietly start building a shadow platform.
Shadow IT is incredibly corrosive.
It's the worst. It happens when an application team gets frustrated by the official process, pulls out a corporate credit card, spins up a server completely outside the official network, and writes their own glue code to make things work.
Suddenly, you have undocumented, unmonitored infrastructure handling company data.
Right. And to prevent that, a platform team has to be humble enough to actively listen to user feedback, but confident enough to enforce firm, uncompromising standards.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because enforcing standards naturally brings up the tension of abstraction.
Yeah.
How much freedom do you actually give these T-shaped engineers using the platform? If the platform just hands out raw cloud accounts, it's not really a platform, it's just AWS with a corporate logo slapped on it.
True.
But if the platform abstractions are too thick, You've built a proprietary, homegrown monster that no new hire knows how to use and no outside software vendor will ever support.
Finding that Goldilocks zone of abstraction is the hardest part of platform engineering. The author solved this tension by implementing what they call golden paths.
Golden paths.
Yeah. A golden path is a highly opinionated, smoothly paved road designed for the 80% of applications that are totally standard. If an internal team is building a basic run-of-the-mill web service, they stay on the golden path.
And the platform just handles the heavy lifting.
Exactly. The platform automatically handles their servers, their scaling, and their security. The developers never have to think about infrastructure.
But they also built explicit escape hatches for the 20% of applications that genuinely require custom engineering.
Yes. For example, if a team is building a highly specialized, low-latency trading bridge that needs to bypass the standard security proxies to operate at absolute maximum speed, they can take the escape hatch.
Right.
They drop down to a lower level of the infrastructure and manage the complexity themselves.
Yeah, and the author warns that without those escape hatches, you end up constructing a gilded cage.
It's such an evocative metaphor.
It really is. A gilded cage looks beautiful from the outside. The developer experience seems flawless. But the moment the company tries to launch a new kind of product, say, training a massive machine learning model that requires specialized GPUs, the platform rejects it.
Because it wasn't built for that.
Exactly. The bars of the cage physically prevent the organization from expanding its wings because the platform was rigidly designed to only support standard web apps.
It's a profound leadership lesson about the nature of empowerment. Managers often assume that empowering a software team means handing them a blank check, letting them pick whatever database, language, or framework they desire.
Just do whatever you want.
Right. But the author argues that true empowerment actually lies in ruthlessly eliminating low-value decisions. By taking away a team's ability to invent their own custom deployment pipeline from scratch, you free up massive amounts of cognitive load.
Allowing them to focus entirely on solving actual business problems. They don't have to reinvent a wheel. They just get to drive the car. Now, as wildly successful as this entire architecture was, the author's retrospective isn't a victory lap.
No, they are surprisingly candid.
Very candid about the massive strategic errors they made, the choices that still keep them up at night. There are three major regrets. And the first one tackles a debate that rages in every tech boardroom, the multi-cloud strategy.
Oh, boy.
The author states unequivocally that they wish they had killed their multi-cloud aspirations much, much faster.
This raises an important question because the author is directly challenging a piece of deeply ingrained conventional wisdom here.
Right. The standard advice is that you should never put all your operational eggs in one vendor's basket.
Precisely. Executives assume that running your systems across both AWS and Microsoft Azure simultaneously protects the company from vendor lock-in and gives you leverage in pricing negotiations.
But the author found that chasing that safety net created an operational nightmare.
Because the complexity tax is staggering. Unless a company is facing highly specific sovereign data laws that legally force them to use local providers in different countries, multi-cloud is usually a fantasy.
How bad is the tax, really?
Well, think about it. When you attempt to run active production environments across two entirely different clouds, your engineering teams have to learn and maintain two entirely distinct technological ecosystems.
That's double the work.
It is. Your central security team has to learn how to audit AWS logs and Azure logs, which look completely different. Your finance department has to reconcile two vastly different billing structures. It dilutes your organization's expertise across the board.
You end up paying a heavy daily tax for a disaster scenario that you probably don't actually have.
Exactly. The author clarifies that what companies actually need is robust regional resilience. If an Amazon data center in Virginia loses power, your system should automatically fail over to an Amazon data center in Ohio.
So it's still AWS, just a different location.
Right. You need a defensible disaster recovery plan, meaning your code is written cleanly enough that in a catastrophic company-ending scenario, you could theoretically migrate to another vendor.
But you do not need to proactively bleed engineering hours maintaining that second environment every single day.
That complexity tax totally negates the imagined safety.
And speaking of bleeding resources, that brings us to the author's second major regret. Phoenix, or financial operations in the cloud.
This is a big one.
It is. The author proudly notes that during a recent efficiency push, their team achieved an incredible 46% effective optimization rate on their cloud costs. which sounds like a monumental victory for the company.
It sounds great on paper.
But the regret stems from the fact that they treated cost optimization as a retroactive phase two cleanup project.
Yeah, their hard-earned realization is that every single dollar you manage to save through a retroactive cleanup campaign is a dollar you already wasted in the first place.
And that doesn't even factor in the sheer volume of expensive engineering hours burned auditing old systems, tracking down the owners of abandoned servers, and carefully turning them off without breaking production.
The author uses a phenomenal analogy for this. They say that if a rogue workload accidentally burns through a massive infrastructure budget over a single holiday weekend, that isn't actually a finance problem.
Right.
It is an engineering problem wearing a finance costume. It's like building a high-performance sports car, completely taping over the dashboard fuel gauge, driving it aggressively for a year, and then acting shocked when the gas bill arrives in the mail 30 days later.
That is the perfect way to describe it.
The mechanism of visibility is everything. If leadership wants engineering teams to genuinely care about operational costs, you can't hide the invoices from them for 3 years and then suddenly mandate a 20% cost reduction.
You have to build granular cost visibility directly into the foundation.
Exactly. That means enforcing strict tagging mechanisms, attaching digital metadata to every single cloud resource so you know exactly which team spun up that expensive server.
And implementing anomaly detection.
Right. So instead of finding out about a budget overrun at the end of the month, a Slack alert fires off 3 hours after the spending spike begins. When engineers can see the immediate financial implications of their code, they organically design more efficient systems.
Okay, so we have the multi-cloud complexity tax, and we have the pain of retroactive FinOps.
Yeah.
But the final regret, the one the author says was their most expensive mistake of all, is that they didn't standardize their tools harder and sooner.
This is a trap that almost every empathetic leader falls into.
Yeah.
In the early days of building the platform, the author wanted to be viewed as a collaborative partner, so they allowed individual application teams to pick their own continuous integration tools, the automated software assembly lines that merge and test code.
They let teams choose their own secret managers for passwords.
They even let them use their own base images, which are the blank slate operating system templates developers use as a starting point for their apps. The platform team believed that allowing this variability would build trust and goodwill by meeting the developers where this were.
But 5 years later, that goodwill had metastasized into an unpayable technical debt.
Totally.
Imagine a critical zero-day security vulnerability hits the industry. The central platform team needs to urgently patch every system. But because they allowed so much freedom early on, they discover 40 different base images running in the wild.
That's a nightmare.
They have to navigate a dozen entirely different continuous integration pipelines just to push the security update. Every time they want to upgrade a basic protocol, they have to untangle a bespoke, customized setup.
The variability that felt so empowering in year one became a logistical nightmare in year five.
Unbelievable.
The realization is painful but clear. You cannot simply refinance a compounding technical debt. You can only slowly, painfully pay it down while the interest continues to accrue. Yeah, if the author could start from scratch today, they would offer a drastically smaller menu of choices. The default toolkit provided to engineers would be sharp, opinionated, and absolutely non-negotiable.
They acknowledge that the application teams might have pushed back fiercely in the first few months.
Oh, definitely. But by year five, the ability to seamlessly upgrade the entire company's infrastructure in a single afternoon would have made them incredibly thankful.
So what does this all mean for us? When we step back and look at this entire five-year journey, from refusing to let developers bypass the centralized landing zone to insisting on generalist engineers, all the way through the painful regrets about multi-cloud aspirations and delayed standardization, the central, unifying theme comes into sharp focus.
It really does.
The true advantage of a greenfield build, of getting the rare opportunity to start an ambitious project entirely from scratch, isn't that you get to play with the shiny new software tools. It isn't even that you get to avoid dealing with legacy databases.
Because the shiny new technology of today is guaranteed to be the frustrating legacy technology of tomorrow. That cycle is unavoidable.
Exactly. The true lasting advantage of a greenfield opportunity is the absolute absence of bad habits. You are handed the incredibly rare gift of encoding the behavioral rules of the system into the machinery itself, long before anyone has had the chance to build a messy, customized workaround.
You get to pour the concrete for the guardrails before a single person has the chance to violate a policy.
And for you listening, whether you are managing a rapidly growing software engineering department, laying the groundwork for a brand new small business, or honestly just trying to finally organize your own digital file systems, the underlying lesson here is entirely universal. You have to make the right thing the easy thing.
Yes.
And you have to make the secure default the only thing. Standardize your processes early, even if it feels overly rigid or confrontational in the moment, because you are actively freeing up massive amounts of your future energy.
It is a profound framework for approaching any complex system. And as we wrap up today's analysis, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Look critically at your own current projects, your business operations, or even your daily personal workflows. Are you unknowingly making just this once exceptions today to save a little time? Are you creating temporary duct tape workarounds that are silently calcifying into permanent bad habits? We all romanticize the idea of total freedom and boundless choices when we start a new endeavor. But what if the true hidden cost of total flexibility today is the complete loss of your agility tomorrow? Are you taking the time to lay down a robust, scalable city grid? Or are you just letting everyone pitch a tent wherever they want and hoping it somehow resembles a functional city 5 years from now?
That is a phenomenal question we all need to be asking ourselves about the systems we manage. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take a hard look at the foundations you're building today. We'll see you next time.